You're listening to
WGXC Accra,
Hudson Catskill,
90.7 FM.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You've tuned into All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Kirby Crone of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Graham. Natasha Von Holdridge is reporting for Columbia Greene Media. Columbia County health officials reported on September 2nd the county's 98th death attributed to COVID-19. Columbia County Department of Health Director Jack Mabb said, and I quote, "We had another death overnight. It was a gentleman under 40. He was unvaccinated. That bothers me. That bothers me a lot." End quote. Mabb said the man was a resident of the Hudson Greenport area. He said, and I quote, "He had been in the hospital and been intubated and just lost the fight." End quote. There are currently 9 county residents hospitalized because of the virus. Only one of those 9 people had been vaccinated, and that individual is an older person with comorbidities. This week, the Department of Health announced that more than 70% of people 12 and older in Columbia County were fully vaccinated. Mabb said, and I quote, "This is fully vaccinated, so it's both shots," end quote. In Greene County, 58.2% of all people 12 and older are fully vaccinated. Mabb said about 25% of the county's newly diagnosed are breakthrough cases, which are positive cases found in fully vaccinated people. The county DOH will conduct a vaccination pod at the Columbia County Fairgrounds in Chatham from 4 to 7 p.m. on September 15th and vaccinates people at their offices in Hudson every Tuesday. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Melanie Lekasevic is reporting for Capital Region Independent Media. The Ravenna Coeman Selkirk School District is finalizing its reopening plan for the 2021-22 school year. Students and staff are preparing to return after a year of hybrid instruction, rotating students between virtual and in-person learning designed to prevent the transmission of the COVID-19 virus. In the upcoming school year, RCS students will return to the classroom full-time. District Superintendent Brian Bailey said in a letter to families on August 23rd, and I quote, "We have been strategizing how we will provide quality instruction while keeping our students and staff safe," end quote. Governor Kathy Hochul on August 24th mandated face masks indoors while on school grounds and buses, regardless of vaccination status, and face coverings outdoors are currently optional. Physical distancing will continue to be practiced in the district as the new school year begins, but recommendations by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been reduced from 6 feet to 3 feet. Bailey said in the letter, and I quote, "The updated guidance from the Centers for Disease Control has identified that social distancing at 3 feet will be acceptable in most situations. This will be helpful as we set up our classrooms. Day-to-day logistics such as arrival, dismissal, lunches, travel between classes, and the use or sharing of materials are being examined so that our schools may operate smoothly while maintaining a sense of community and normalcy," end quote. Students will return to their usual buildings when school begins September 8th. Bus transportation will return to full capacity for the 2021-22 school year, and masks must be worn at all times by everyone on the bus, according to the district. Windows will be opened, weather permitting, to increase air circulation and to discourage the potential spread of the coronavirus. You can read the full story in the Ravenna News Herald. Larry Rulison is reporting for the Times Union. Nauman Hussein, September 2nd, pleaded guilty to criminally negligent homicide charges. The plea was the first time the operator of Prestige Limousine admitted that his failure to maintain his stretch limousine led to the October 6, 2018 crash that killed 20 people, the 18 in the vehicle, as well as two pedestrians. The crash remains the nation's deadliest transportation disaster in more than 10 years. Under the terms of the plea deal, Hussein will serve no prison time. The agreement was negotiated by his attorney, Lee Kendlong, and Schoharie County District Attorney Susan Mallory. Hussein agreed to plead guilty to 20 counts of criminally negligent homicide in exchange for 5 years of probation and 1,000 hours of community service that will include public speaking appearances. And he will be barred from working in the transportation industry. During the proceedings, one by one, the victims' names were read out by Judge George Bartlett III as he asked Hussein if he caused each death. Hussein answered 20 times, and I quote, "Yes," end quote. People could be heard sobbing. One woman said, and I quote, "He killed 20 people. F this," end quote, before court officials prompted her to leave. The hearings were held at a local school to accommodate the huge crowd of family and friends of the victims of the crash. The 31-year-old Hussein is likely to be the only person to ever face criminal charges in the case. The limousine was rented to take passengers to a birthday celebration in Cooperstown. Hussein allegedly ignored warnings from the State Department of Transportation that the excursion he was renting out was dangerous. He repeatedly failed safety inspections and lacked state and federal certifications. Read the full story in the Times Union. William J. Kimball reports in the Daily Freeman that the town of Rhinebeck in Dutchess County voted 4-1 September 1st to not allow cannabis retail sales there. While Supervisor Elizabeth Spenza claimed she was in favor of selling cannabis there, she voted against selling cannabis there. She said, and I quote, "I'm pro-dispensaries, but I don't know what I'm buying into. I want to see what the law looks like," end quote. The laws are similar to Massachusetts and other states where legalization has already happened. Kimball does not quote any board members about why they voted against taking in the tax money from retail sales. Board member Josh Pulver was the lone vote in favor of cannabis sales in Rhinebeck. He said, and I quote, "I think it is here cannabis is legalized, and I think it's just a lot of legislation to get out, then to get back in," end quote. Towns have until December 31st to opt out of recreational cannabis sales under the legalization law passed 5 months ago in New York. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo, long opposed to legalization, did not nominate anyone for the regulatory boards setting cannabis selling rules. But on September 1st, new Governor Kathy Hochul nominated Christopher Alexander to head the Office of Cannabis Management and Tremaine Wright to chair the state's Cannabis Control Board. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice Labor Day week.
Podcasts get made locally at WGXC.org, as all WGXC's locally produced programs can be subscribed to and found in all the usual podcasting places. Tune in for a mind-expanding radio from local news to a travelogue of sounds, either live at 90.7 FM or anytime at WGXC.org.
From the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Americans have a new normal, relying on high-speed internet for video meetings, working from home, accessing healthcare, and much more. But it's called the digital divide for a reason. Broadband, necessary for high speed, is harder to come by and more expensive in rural areas.
We know that rural subscribers and tribal subscribers are paying up to about 37% more for broadband than those in built-up areas.
Whitney Kimball Coe with the Center for Rural Strategies is part of a coalition called Let's Broadband Together. Consumer Reports has a survey so they can learn more about broadband inequities. You can download the short survey at consumerreports.org. With enough broadband, rural towns hope to support remote workers. The Southern Oregon coastal community of Port Orford hopes the infrastructure bill will help funding for a sustainable fisheries hub, including a live fish processing center. Port President Aaron Ashdown says having live tanks provides added value for consumers and tourists.
There have been plenty of groups that have looked at Port Orford. You know, they're like, well, wow, this is working. It's a self-sustaining port.
Ashdown wants to see more remote coastal towns embrace blue economies to create local living wage jobs. Nearly 3,000 miles east in rural Alabama's Black Belt, some families are opening their farms to ecotourism. For Christopher Joe, a black farmer in the region, it was important to stick to his family's cattle farming roots near Greensboro and welcome hikers and bird watchers who love to see swallow-tailed kites soar above his pastures.
I feel a sense of pride knowing that when I say the Joe Farm, a lot of people are like, oh, okay, I heard about that.
The Joe family allowed the Audubon Society to create 6 miles of trails. Karina Newsom with the Georgia Audubon Society attended their Black Belt Birding Festival in Greensboro last month.
Being outdoor and wildlife enthusiasts and then making their space available, and particularly being a role model for young black people, I had to come.
Finally, the number of rural Americans who have completed their COVID-19 vaccinations grew by nearly 300,000 last week, though caregivers are increasingly frustrated by virus skeptics.
And now people are suggesting that we are not telling the truth and they don't know what we're going through every day.
That's Deb Fisher-Clemens, president of the South Dakota Nurses Association, where there's been a nearly 200% increase in daily positive cases since mid-August. In Missouri, some skeptics have been swayed by a $10,000 incentive lottery for vaccinations, which were up 88% in the state last week, according to Daily Yonder data. Sarah Hart Weir with the Missouri Health Department says the lottery was designed with broad eligibility.
We really wanted to make sure that Missourians with disabilities were included.
For the Yonder Report and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
What happened today? There was a protest. It's an International Day of Action. What happened here in Albany?
Today in Albany, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Mariam. Me and two of my close Afghan friends, we joined together so that we could create awareness for the community to speak up about the humanitarian crisis that's happening, that's been happening, and is currently escalating recently in Afghanistan due to the current situation, you know, with the new regime. So our goal for the protest was to just show everyone, you know, what's happening and what things we could do, what kind of resources we could provide to the community to help those that have to seek refuge, because unfortunately this is displacing millions of Afghans throughout the country, and many of them are stuck in the airport and they have nowhere to go. You know, and it's important for us as the Afghan diaspora to be able to speak up and be that generation that's the voice for those that are stuck, the voice for the people that can't be heard. So through the protests, you know, we're hoping to bring some kind of awareness, some kind of education, something for people to say, hey, this is something happening in Afghanistan. Let's look more into it. Let's see what we can do. So I hope, you know, that's something that was addressed and something that reached out to others.
So what were some of the demands from the protests today?
Some of these demands, the protests had a very general message, which was about addressing the humanitarian crisis and having resources to help refugees in the area. But some of the more specific demands that we also outlined was to stop the killing, displacement, and suffering of Afghans. Another was to ask all sides involved of the bloodshed of Afghans for an immediate ceasefire. This especially includes the Taliban, and to just end all proxy wars in Afghan territory. We also want to hold all actors engaged in the war of Afghanistan accountable and pressure them to comply with international laws. And especially looking at the United States' role, we can ask our own government to reconsider its agreement with the Taliban last year and investigate all sources of support for Taliban in addition to other violent extremist groups in Afghanistan and ensure their cessation.
So I was hoping one of you could share a personal story of, you know, how it is you came to the U.S., you know, what your family and friends are dealing with in Afghanistan right now.
So just a very brief history of how my family came to Afghanistan. I mean, I'm sorry, the U.S. In the 70s, 80s, there was what they call the Soviet invasion, as well as the Civil War. They had to escape to Pakistan, the neighboring country. As refugees, they stayed in like refugee camps. And eventually, one of my uncles lived in Pakistan, so they stayed with him for a while. And my family came to the U.S. Shortly after. So, and we've been living here for, I'm like 26, that many years, and plus some. We've gone back a couple times. My mother actually came back a week or even just a couple days before the Taliban took over 90% of the country. The current situation, even just like with family members, some of the family members in provinces outside of Kabul, they've had to literally escape the Taliban and kind of try to retreat back to their tribes, back to their homelands. People, family members in Kabul, they are just trying to, I guess, get by each day. They've visited the Kabul airport a couple times. More recently, a couple of family members went there around the time of the recent bomb attacks. And, you know, just continually being just basically threatened and scared. And it's not even sometimes about what's happening in the airport currently. It's even just getting to the airport, even just getting back home.
I don't know if either one of you want to share any stories about friends and family that are at home, you know, in Afghanistan, what the situation is like right now.
I mean, I feel like this kind of goes for the majority of the Afghans, especially for, you know, the ones that are living outside of the country. A lot of us just kind of feel hopeless, not knowing what we can do, not knowing what there is to do, because the process, it just pretty much seems it's very complicated. We all have family members and we all have friends and relatives that we know of that are pretty much stuck at this one airport that everyone's trying to escape from. So there's nothing else really much to say about that. It's unfortunate.
Well, I feel like I was kind of already represented when she spoke before, but this lady sitting right next to me is my aunt. But our family was mostly displaced after the Soviet invasion in the 70s. And more specifically, one of the first people to come to this country was our uncle, my great uncle, actually. And he was actually sponsored by a man named Tom Little. And he was like a team leader with the International Assistance Mission, and he basically sponsored him and helped him get to this country. So, yeah.
So the American invasion and then ensuing occupation of Afghanistan has been the longest running war in U.S. history, 20 years, and you know, just sitting here right now reflecting on that, not to mention previously, right, there was a Russian invasion and occupation, which happened. It's been many, many decades of foreign invasion, occupation, you know, destabilization. I think there's quite a few Americans who are relieved that U.S. troops are finally mostly pulling out, but I think many people are also upset in the way it's being done. I think it's hard for a lot of people to try and figure out what's the right way to do this. I don't know if you have any ideas of what should be done differently. What is the right way in your view to handle the current situation?
You really have to look at the U.S. leaders. They have a lot of power, a lot of allies on their side. And, you know, they could cut ties with their allies who are the imperial powers affecting Afghanistan. They could just cut ties with them. And I don't want to say save people's lives, but avoid further casualties. One of the main contributors is Pakistan. That is a well-known fact, regardless of anyone's personal opinion. There is evidence of, you know, weaponry being passed across the border. Meanwhile, Afghans in Pakistan can't get to their families in Afghanistan. There's also discussions between the leaders from Reagan's time. So it's been like a long, kind of like they're using Afghanistan as like a playing field for their for stealing resources, causing destruction, and basically just trying to take Afghanistan away from the Afghan people. It all leads down to the imperial leaders and their power and their choices and the support they're getting from their allies.
So what can you all recommend for people to do, to help out in this crisis right now?
I think it's always nice to, first off, welcome refugees from any country with warm and open arms. You don't know what these people have gone through, what kind of tragedies they're facing, and there's a reason why they're leaving their home country in the first place. So I just would want to get that out there first. I think it's very important we help these people. Second, I think we should also look more into what kind of community resources you have in the area that are willing to help these people. What kind of education system can we, you know, kind of sponsor them in? Like, are there school programs to help them with, you know, in this situation, English, or what other requirements may be needed? There might be soup kitchens. There can also be donation centers. Like, people who are actually willing to help will make it known. And if you just kind of research and ask around, you can find places. I mean, locally here we have the Muslim Soup Kitchen, who is run by a very well-known leader in the community as well. She's been working with us for many years. and they provide donation sites, and they're asking people in the community to come and volunteer so people can help out and give donations and provide simple basic needs, because we have to remember at the end of the day these people come with nothing, and it's up to us as a community to make them feel welcome, because that could easily have been us, that could easily have been our parents if they had not come here. So it's always important to give back. There's always all those community resources, so just kind of educate yourselves, look around, ask around, and just help out.
And is there anything else any of you would like to add?
I think on a personal level, when I grew up in Albany, and we didn't really have a center to go to, we didn't have really any Afghan community outreach. We kind of created our own communities because I think more in our culture, and even Eastern cultures, Asian cultures, We perform society as like a communal activity. I think probably the American or Western culture is more individualized, so they need that communal community where they can, the kids can just like play outside with each other and the neighbors, and they're speaking the same language, and they have a culture enriched day to day. Which, I wish I had that when I was younger, because I think Afghans back in the 90s and 80s, they were just coming with, like, the clothes on their back and just tried to get help from the state. So just something to think about, and something to try to motivate other people, other non-Afghans, to volunteer, because we do have the power and, like, the resources. We just need to know... We just need to do better, basically.
There's one final question I want to ask. So I'm sitting down with three younger Afghan women who are the ones that ultimately organized this protest today, and you're not alone, right? There's plenty of other younger Afghan women, women of all ages, that are helping organize these protests across the U.S. and around the world, also in Afghanistan itself, right? I mean, just a few weeks ago, bunch of Afghan women who took up arms and were saying that they would fight the Taliban if need be. Could you say something about that, about this point in time and the role that Afghan women are playing in this form of struggle and resistance in the U.S. and at home?
I think that Afghan women in Afghanistan, they're playing very pressured and very very difficult role, because the new regime, the Taliban, they see them as subhuman. They don't see them as human beings. And that's a shared opinion of, I think, Afghan women all around the world. And I just think that I honestly don't know where they get their resilience or their confidence and motivation from. But it's really inspiring, and I just feel like we couldn't give back what they give to us in the U.S. They're playing a huge role, and we can all learn from that.
I think also prior to all these invasions and unfortunate circumstances within the country throughout the years, Afghan women always had rights. It's just the hungry world powers and the political agendas of all these not so good people that are taking over, they're just taking that away from them, and they don't realize that these women will always have that resilience within them. They will always fight for their chance for education, to be able to work, to be able to work in whatever kind of career they choose to be, not something that's only approved because they're female. So this protest that we did today, these protests that are happening around the world, not only is it just for Afghan women, but I feel that the majority could probably agree that Afghan women are probably going to struggle the most, whether it's physically, mentally, emotionally. There's just a lot more restriction with being a female in general. And for us to be able to raise our voice and show them that we are hearing them, we are here for them, in whatever way possible, it's important for us to keep bringing that up, because these are rights that no one should take away from a woman.
Hi, I'm John from Coxsackie. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA.
After years of virtual collaborations across the Pacific Rim, the duo Alula produced their Akari album in a Tokyo studio. On the next Deep Threes, we'll hear the results. Plus music from Enrico Raba, Nikki Costa, Todd Oxford, James Dunham, and Tan Dunn. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Kravitz & Son Roofing, a local family-owned and operated full-service roofing company for more than 48 years. Specializing in residential and commercial roof construction, repair, maintenance, and replacement, using high-quality and affordable roofing products. Information at 518-567-4026. Or online at KravitzandSonRoofing.com.
WGXC is made possible in part for the generous ongoing support of Sam Sebrin of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, September the 2nd, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. President Joe Biden stepped into the abortion battle in Texas Thursday, tasking federal agencies to see what steps can be taken to, in his words, ensure that women in Texas have access to safe and legal abortions.
The law, which took effect Wednesday, bans most abortions after 6 weeks. That's before most women know they're pregnant. Brandi Collins Calhoun with the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, which assists people and communities with the least wealth and opportunity, notes the law also allows private citizens to sue anyone providing help to an abortion patient.
With this ban, it comes with a $10,000 bounty on anybody who assists people in obtaining an abortion. That could be the providers, clergy, friends.
The White House response came hours after the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 vote, declined to block the Texas law from taking effect. I'm Roz Brown.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Thursday she plans to bring up legislation to codify the landmark 1973 decision when the House returns from recess this month. Now from the New York Times, in the aftermath of a ferocious storm caused by the remnants of Hurricane Ida that killed more than 36 people in 4 states, national and local leaders acknowledged Thursday that extreme weather events posed an urgent and ongoing threat. The Times reports the storm killed at least 43 people in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut, and left more than 150,000 homes without power. States of emergency remained in effect across the region by midday Thursday as officials sought to get a handle on the damage. North Dakota's governor and healthcare leaders want residents to take COVID-19 seriously to prevent the snowball effects of the latest variant surge. Community health centers are stepping up to help.
This week saw Governor Doug Burgum and large health systems plead with North Dakotans to get their vaccinations and wear masks, or more hospitals will be pushed to the limit this fall. Only 51% of residents 18 and older have received all their shots. Lori Dumke of Northland Health Center says with misinformation still flying around, their clinics are trying to put skeptics at ease by connecting with prominent figures in communities with low access to care.
Can we take a picture of you getting a vaccine? You know, just showing in the community that your trusted leaders are for it, I think is a huge step forward.
The National Association of Community Health Centers says in the U.S., clinics have administered 15 million COVID shots. Those still reluctant to get vaccinated cite reasons such as personal freedom or mistrust of government. I'm Mike Moen.
North Dakota's rolling 14-day average positivity rate for COVID cases had fallen to 1% in early July. It has now crept up to nearly 7% going into September. This is PNS. Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Bob Casey has introduced legislation to expand Medicare coverage to include dental, hearing, and vision care. Backers of the bill in the Commonwealth say adding those services could do a lot to help older adults stay healthy.
Senate Bill 2618 would cover routine dental cleaning, eyeglasses, hearing exams, and more. In many cases, older adults go without these services, particularly hearing aids, because of the cost. Joanne Grossi of AARP Pennsylvania says it's time for Medicare to treat the whole person, head to toe.
If you can't have a conversation with someone, you're obviously socially isolated. You can't hear the phone ring. It leads to increased isolation and depression, which ironically end up costing the healthcare system more money and Medicare more money because they're leading to these detrimental health outcomes.
Grossi spoke this week in Wilkes-Barre at a special committee on aging hearing, which Senator Casey chairs. Casey said he hopes the legislation is passed when the Senate is back in session as part of the budget reconciliation process. Some pushback is expected from lawmakers who will question the cost. I'm Emily Scott.
Medicare provides coverage to 2.8 million Pennsylvanians 65 and older and those with chronic disabilities. In less than 2 weeks now, proposed maps will be available to New Mexico residents who are following the once-in-a-decade redrawing of U.S. congressional and state legislative boundaries. Dick Mason represents the New Mexico League of Voters and says the group is pushing for as much transparency as is possible.
On September 16th, they're going to be publishing the concept maps. And then after that, they're going to go out with public meetings with these concept maps to get people's input on those maps.
Advocates for fair redistricting say it is supposed to preserve communities of common interest. Organizations providing relief support for Afghan refugees say more people can help simply by taking time to learn about the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
Groups like Catholic Charities Jacksonville are preparing to handle a surge of over 150 Afghan refugees who'll need basics like food, housing, and jobs as they begin their new lives in the community in the next few months. At the same time, Matt Schmidt with Catholic Charities says he's been trying to help clear up some misunderstandings that stem in part from the name of the effort, the Afghan Parolee Support Program.
People are worried that the refugees that are coming from Afghanistan are a security threat. They're concerned that the term parolee, by the way, it sounds like someone who's been released from jail or from prison. And that is the farthest from the truth.
I'm Tramell Gomes.
The State Department named Jacksonville among the top 19 welcoming cities for refugees. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, heard on radio stations big and small, and find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Graham. Bethany Bump reports in the Times Union that the COVID-19 outbreak in Albany County is so bad now that on September 3rd, officials held their first COVID-19 briefing since June. Albany County Executive Dan McCoy and Health Commissioner Dr. Elizabeth Whalen used to hold daily briefings about the local reaction to the pandemic, and they were back on the mic to warn about spread among young people. Whalen said, comparing the variant that hit the U.S. last fall with Delta, and I quote, "younger individuals with the Alpha variant we know had a level of comfort that if they got sick, they weren't going to get that sick. That comfort level is not there anymore," end quote. 8 Albany County residents died from COVID-19 this week. 1 was in their 30s, 2 were in their 40s, 2 were in their 50s, 2 were in their 60s, and 1 was in their 70s. The majority of those ending up in the hospital dying from COVID-19 now are unvaccinated, Whalen said. She urged everyone to wear masks, especially now that school is restarting. She said, and I quote, "Please, we know that these masks are going to be mandated for children. They will take their cue from you. If they feel their parents are very angry and very upset, this filters down to the children, and it's not helpful. It's a mandate at this point, and so to help your children get through this, any positive reinforcement that you give will be more helpful than to see the stress," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Ray Whalen reports for Spectrum that 2 state assembly members have tested positive for COVID-19.
Democrats Charles Fall and Inez Dickens, both vaccinated, are currently quarantining. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie said, and I quote, "I send Charles and Inez well wishes and hope they have a full and speedy recovery. This is a terrible reminder that we are not yet out of the woods of this pandemic," end quote. He added, and I quote, "I encourage everyone to stay vigilant and careful to protect yourself and those around you," end quote. The state legislature held a special session on September 1st, so more COVID-19 announcements could be forthcoming. One source who is waiting on his own test results after the special session said, and I quote, "The extraordinary session may have turned into an extraordinary super spreader event," end quote. Read more about this story at Spectrum. Noah Zweifeld reports for the Altamont Enterprise that opportunities of renewable solar energy often cite many what-ifs, including the chance of fire, when arguing against local arrays. Now they can discuss one local solar project that has caught fire twice this year. The Shepherd Farm solar fields in Westerloo caught fire August 30th after a control box short-circuited. Westerloo Volunteer Fire Department Assistant Chief Don Filkins said, and I quote, "Something had shorted inside the box and it caught fire, and the fire burned through the box," end quote. A different control box combusted in a similar manner in the spring. Filkin said, and I quote, "The same issue happened, but that one didn't get quite as burned. It's kind of a recurring issue now. But on a good note, we're getting a lot of training on solar power and energy, so that's great," end quote. No one was hurt, and there was little damage from either fire. A public relations representative for the owners, Borrego, told the Enterprise they would answer questions about the incident, but they did not answer questions before the reporter's deadline. Read more about this story in the Altamont Enterprise. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice holiday weekend.
All summer, there are tours at the Hudson Athens Lighthouse every second Saturday of the month through October. You can visit the 1874 lighthouse that's in the middle of the Hudson River. The tours leaving from the Henry Hudson Riverfront Park in Hudson at 11 a.m., noon, 1 p.m., and 2 p.m., and from the Athens Village Riverfront Park at 11:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., 1:30 p.m., and 2:30 p.m. That's the Hudson Athens Lighthouse tours all summer on the second Saturday. And you can find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Lauren Jones of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
All Together Now listens for feedback from the public. Anyone who wants to leave a public comment can call 518-291-9492 and leave an audio message up to 3 minutes with any sort of opinion about something you heard on All Together Now. You can also send emails to info@wgxc.org with opinions about what you hear here.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
To be clear, we have no specific threat information or information regarding attacks this weekend, but what we do have is history.
Deputy National Security Advisor Anne Neuberger warned Americans of possible ransomware attacks over Labor Day weekend, noting many IT professionals will be out of the office.
We also need to look at our own activity to ensure that we're doing everything we can to lock our digital doors and ensure that our networks and our organizations are as safe as they need to be online.
Stepping up cyber networks and increasing spending are key elements of the House Armed Service Committee's version of the National Defense Authorization Act, which now heads to the House floor. Massachusetts Democrat Seth Moulton argued the U.S. must do more to compete.
China's beating us at our own game because they're spending their money more effectively. And that's the true challenge facing us.
14 Democrats voted with Republicans to approve more Pentagon spending, bringing the total to $740 billion instead of $715 billion proposed by the White House. A group of 26 Republican senators are calling on President Joe Biden to provide details about the humanitarian crisis left in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The coalition, including Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, requested details on the number of Americans and allies left behind, as well as the vetting process for evacuees who are being brought to the U.S.
President Biden screwed this up every way you could screw it up. He needs to be held accountable, and I want to know the following. Did he turn down good advice, or was he given bad advice? Time will tell.
Meanwhile, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is reported to be among a group of Republicans whose phone records are of interest to the Select Committee investigating the January 6 riot. Earlier this week, McCarthy warned any telecommunication company to comply with the committee's request was breaking the law, a claim quickly debunked by researchers. After the Supreme Court refused to block a new Texas abortion law, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi promised to bring a bill codifying Roe v. Wade to the House floor.
There will be other states that may copy the Texas model, which is not a state action, but right of private action, which is clever, very, very dangerous. And so, you know, we expect to see copycats.
The Texas law prohibits the procedure once medical professionals can detect cardiac activity, usually around 6 weeks. It also allows for civil suits to be filed against abortion providers. West Virginia moderate Joe Manchin wants the Senate to stop for a beat before proceeding with President Biden's $3.5 trillion spending package, which is expected to feature key Democratic social spending priorities. Manchin said a pause is needed to see if the current level of inflation is transitory, given concerns about the Afghanistan withdrawal and the spread of the Delta variant of COVID-19. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Well, we're lucky enough to be joined right now by Corrine Carey. She's here to discuss the upcoming series interviewing candidates in Rensselaer County for this November election and what we're trying to do with this project. She's going to be talking to us about it. Hello and welcome, Corrine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell me, what are we going to be doing with this series? It sounds very interesting.
Well, we're going to be doing a series of candidate profile interviews with hopefully all 38 of the Troy-based candidates for local office. We've got 5 different offices that we're looking at, 38 candidates, and 5 different parties. It's quite an endeavor, and we're going to start with an overview that I did with a current city council person, Anasha Cummings, that I think will air tomorrow, that kind of does an overview of what's at stake in Troy, what do all these political parties mean. Part 2 with him will air, and then we'll hopefully get right into the candidate interviews.
You said there were 5 offices. I'm thinking county legislature, city council, county clerk, county executive. Which one am I missing?
The family court judge.
Family court judge. And we don't want to totally give away what you're going to talk to Nash about, but was there anything that he talked to you about that surprised you or you hadn't known about previously?
Well, I think I've been really interested in trying to figure out the layout of all the people running on different lines. So I mentioned we had 5 parties. And I think that for an average voter that goes into the voting booth, even if they may have learned this somewhere along the line, it's really difficult to understand why you can see one candidate on three different lines and what that means and where should you mark the ballot? So Anasha and I talked a little bit about what those parties are and some of the party shenanigans that have gone on this year, frankly. So really interesting interview. I hope people tune in to hear that.
So what kind of questions will you be asking these candidates? Will you be looking into their history or their political and social history or issues that they're most focused on?
Yeah, so the way that I usually do these interviews, and I've been doing interviews with local candidates for the past 3 years, is it's really a candidate profile. What I find frustrating is that most people, when they go into the voting booth, if they've seen the names before, it may have been in passing on a flyer. They really don't know who these people are at all. So what I try to do is come up with a series of 5 to 6 questions that I'll ask every single candidate. Why are you running, for example? I ask them about, some of the bigger issues that people in that office will have to face. I ask them what in their experience qualifies them for this position. Sometimes I ask them what challenges they've faced, either in the position if they're an incumbent or in a previous position that they might have held. And then I ask them what they do. This is my favorite question. I ask them what they do when they're not out on the campaign trail. What do they do for fun? What do they do for distraction? And I have to say, I learned a lot during the primary when I was asking some of the candidates what they do for fun. And I realized what a lighthearted question that is for people that aren't feeling very lighthearted right now. So a couple of the candidates said, there's not a whole lot of fun to be had right now, and told me what they were working on. And that was a real, it's kind of a more of a wake up call for me to ask the question a little bit differently.
You mentioned earlier the shenanigans that go on, particularly in Troy among the political parties. And clearly one of the big issues this year was after Cindy Doran and Peter Grimm, who are the minority leaders of the county legislature, supported a resolution in support of the Black Lives Matter movement, it seemed like the party Democrats and Troy sort of bounced them, and big primary fights both in the Democratic Party and the Working Families Party. And now it seems like the older, more conservative part have created this new party called the Troy Strong Party. How can voters figure all this out? I mean, even us who follow this find it mystifying. And are you going to be able to ask the candidates to explain what's going on with all that?
Oh, you better believe it. I'm definitely going to ask the candidates what's going on. I've been trying to get more information from folks who've been involved in local politics for a long time. But the answer, Mark, is that I don't really know what's going on with the Troy Strong Party. I mean, any group of candidates or any candidate can go out and get enough signatures to get on the ballot line for these local elections, a new ballot line. And everybody, look, for the longest time, Republicans and conservatives, Republicans would run on both the Republican Party line and the Conservative Party line. So when you look at the ballot, one person could be listed on these two lines. And I think the Democrats are looking at trying to get more ballot lines, frankly. We have what's called fusion voting here in New York, and Anasha explains that really well in the interview that'll air hopefully tomorrow. But, I think the goal is to get on as many party lines as you can. I mean, ideally, you'd want to be on the Democratic Party line, the Working Families Party line, and the Troy Strong Party. But it's kind of unclear to me what this Troy Strong Party is. I mean, you made one implication that, two of the lawmakers who voted for a resolution in support of Black Lives Matter at the county legislative level are not in the Troy Strong Party, sorry. And then there are a couple of city council candidates that are running on the Troy Strong Party. And I think at this point, until we get some answers, it's left to voter speculation to try to figure out how these people line up in the different parties. What does the Troy Strong Party stand for? I've put that question to folks in the Troy Strong Party, and I hope to get an answer for our listeners.
To get back to the Troy Strong Party, as you may remember, a couple of years ago, 6 years ago, Democrat split. Some ended up in the Working Families Party line, some in the Democratic Party line, and ended up with the Republicans winning control for a while, the Troy City Council. In this case, the county legislature, where you run in Troy at large, so you pick the top six, you now basically have nine Democrats, six Republicans, which means that the odds that the Republicans will carry some seats dramatically increase. And right now it's been 13 Republicans in the county legislature, six Democrats. Seems like the Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot with this Troy Strong party, which is basically the old guard Democrats, it seems like.
Well, it's an interesting question, Mark, and you can kind of look at how people line up and speculate as to why that is. I mean, why would certain party members rather see Republicans in control than some of the other factions? I think that that's one question that we can ask. We can ask the candidates that, and voters should be asking people who come to the door and ask for their vote. You know, why is this? The other thing that's really interesting is you've got four of the Republican candidates for the Rensselaer County Legislature are running on the Republican line, the Conservative Party line, and the Working Families Party line. Explain that one to me. I mean, talk about party shenanigans. This is the values of the Working Families Party and the Conservative Party could not be more different. So how is it, and I'll certainly be asking the candidates this, how is it that you can run on all three of those party lines at the same time and profess to espouse those values? I don't know if these are folks that are just truly bipartisan and they really do embrace all of these values, or is it that they're trying to get votes out of people who might vote a straight Working Families Party ticket. And frankly, Mark, that's something that many progressive people who have been told for years, vote a straight party ticket on the Working Families Party line, and you're going to be doing justice to your values. That's not true this year. If you vote the straight Working Families Party line, you're not going to be getting the candidates that you may not be getting the candidates that espouse those values.
Well, I think, Corinne, what you're doing is fantastic. And I think that not many stations cover this kind of information, and it'd be wonderful. One other question I had quickly is you vote for the party line rather than for the individual.
Yeah, what it means to vote a straight party line is you just go right down the ballot and click every Working Families Party.
But I mean, if you've got four different levels that you're running on, and all four of them, you know, do they gather them all up and that individual wins?
The individual with the most votes in all of those categories wins. That's what fusion voting is all about, and you can learn more about that during the interview with Anasha.
I can't wait to hear it. Thank you. I think what you're doing is brilliant. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about it. And I hope folks are as excited to listen to these interviews as I am to do them.
Between now and Election Day, Corinne Carey will be reporting on those 38 races involving the city of Troy. And we will also be sneaking in a few races from elsewhere in the Capital District.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Catskill, Acre, Hudson, Chatham, East Chatham, South Chatham, and North Bay.